Navy SEAL senior officer, who has experience in both operational and training environments, what separated a good SEAL leader from one who was great? We expected to hear such adjectives as bravery, toughness, extreme confidence. The officer's unequivocal answer, humility. Every person who achieves the status of a Navy SEAL has shown himself, through years of experience and months of harsh and demanding training, to be exemplary. That is the cost of entry. What distinguishes a great leader, according to this SEAL officer, was the humility that allowed him to recognize what lay before him and his team for what it really was, responding to the unknowable. Theaters of operations in which our military operate are dangerous, ambiguous, and constantly changing environments. Humility enables leaders to understand that they do not have it all figured out, and that what they know is less important than how quickly they learn and adapt. The great leaders are the ones who are willing and able to learn from those from different services, units, ranks, and experiences. The parallels to the CEO journey, and specifically that moment in which aspiring executives come to see their jobs as daily acts of adaptation and agility, are uncanny. Gene Hoffman, founder of the vet pharma company Putney Incorporated, compared life as a CEO to leading people in a foxhole every day. Ali Jamil, the CEO of the Pakistani firm TPL Tracker, told us that in 15 years, as an entrepreneur and CEO, he'd never had a plan that worked from start to finish. We would argue that most of the issues that are known should be addressed by those below the CEO level, freeing the CEO to focus on navigating the unknown. No matter how broad and deep your expertise, whether you're hired from the outside or promoted from within, your job as CEO is to turn the relentless, unending uncertainty the organization will face into opportunity and growth. Most of the leaders we interviewed in this research talked about having to adapt to unexpected challenges or crises. The best leaders thrive in a condition of relentless discomfort, adapting their organizations and themselves. These CEOs chart new paths before they have to, not when there's no other choice. In other words, these leaders reap the benefits of adapting boldly. Our research shows that CEOs who adapt boldly are roughly 7 times more likely to be successful than those who wait for change to confront them. If reliability in our data showed up as the strongest differentiator of performance, adaptability is the behavior that is rapidly growing in importance. In our discussions on the 4 CEO genome behaviors with boards and investors, adaptability gets the highest attention as the increasingly important behavior for success at the top, where playbooks often do not exist. The CEOs who are best at adapting themselves and their organizations to changing conditions have learned to welcome discomfort, conflict, and change. They take the attitude, if I am not uncomfortable, then I am probably not learning or changing fast enough. Being uncomfortable in leading the organization is actually a goal. The role of the CEO is about navigating that pressure and change. This chapter will highlight the key instruments, letting go of the past and building an antenna for the future, to use when sailing through the uncharted waters of the unknown. Let go of the past. Jim Smith, CEO of Thomson Reuters, is one of those rare CEOs who seem to revel in the uncertainty that causes discomfort for so many. He grew up on a farm in Kentucky and boasts no special pedigree. Jim graduated from Marshall University in West Virginia. He didn't attend an Ivy League school or launch his career at a big-name firm such as GE, P&G, or Google. He started out as a journalist, working for the company that years later he would lead as its CEO. Journalism isn't a field commonly associated with the CEO track, but as you'll see later in this chapter, maybe it should be. Even among our diverse CEO pool, Jim Smith is unusually kind, open, and seemingly without affectation. Perhaps more than any other CEO we've met, Jim came into his role prepared for an endless cycle of change. I came to realize early on that if I was going to be successful, then the only thing to build is a culture and an organization and a team of people that would be capable of morphing and changing long after I had left, Jim told us. I can't draw organizational charts fast enough to keep up with the changes in the external market. If you look deeply at the details of his early career, it becomes clear that he had been honing his uncanny comfort with discomfort all along. Hardscrabble beginnings built a foundational expectation that nothing comes easy. One particular story from his early career jumped out at us as a defining moment. Jim was in his first publishing role at Thomson, many years before the company would acquire Reuters to become the world's largest financial news provider. For the first time, his business unit wasn't going to make its monthly targets for ad revenue. He and his team tried everything they could think of to sell more ads. They looked outside their industry practices for ideas, leading to the paper's first department store-style, buy-one-get-one-free white sale. But their out-of-the-box thinking didn't work. "We still didn't make our number," Jim said, laughing easily. Jim didn't give up. He went into the next month with even greater resolve that the executive team would find a way. Instead of fearing failure or shame for the week prior month, he became enthralled by the challenge. They kept hitting the phones, working relationships, tossing out new ideas, and before too long, they were back above targets. "Let's be clear, the white sale never worked," Jim told us, "but something else did, and what mattered was that we came back to fight another day." The lesson Jim took from the experience? You're not going to win every time. You might not even win most of the time. There's a lot of stuff that's not within your control, so how do you bounce back? Do you learn from it? Do you get better? Do you get stronger? Even in an average week, the CEOs we know are uncomfortable about something. Every CEO we meet comes to us carrying a portfolio of near disasters. Like Jim Smith, who now is at the helm of a global media conglomerate, these leaders learn to face the uncertainty of change. They turn fear into courage and curiosity. Recently, Elena was coaching a newly appointed CEO facing a very challenging situation. The CEO said, "I need to remind myself that I've been uncomfortable before and I've succeeded anyway. And knowing that, I can relax and know that it's uncomfortable right now because it's new." We have worked with countless successful leaders who have learned how to strengthen their adapt muscle and embrace the discomfort of the unknown. So what are they doing differently? How did they strengthen that mindset of adaptability and resilience? 1. They actively seek out novelty. If you are not quite ready to be an adaptation black belt in your day job just yet, there are safer and even fun ways to practice. Taking on new habits, skills, and experiences in your personal life could be a safer laboratory for building your adaptation muscles. For example, Nancy Phillips, the CEO of Via West, told us that some of her best training to be CEO didn't take place while she was wearing a suit. She spent 3 years traveling the world, including a month in China during which she never met another Westerner. "I had to learn how to survive every day," she said. Discomfort was the only constant, and every new experience required an improvised response. The expense and time required for a global adventure may not be for you. Learning to play an instrument, to speak a new language, or simply picking up a new hobby are all simple and low-risk ways to raise your adaptation game. It won't make you a bold adapter in a business context overnight, but it will help you grow. 2. They weigh jobs as much by their learning potential as by their pay grade. Dozens of CEOs we've interviewed, and in particular, many of those who have shot to the top faster than average, as you will learn in Chapter 6, have made lateral, unconventional, and even risky career moves. Susan Cameron, the retired CEO of Reynolds American Incorporated, was one of many who told us that taking a lesser role, moving from global brand director to senior vice president of marketing, was the decision that catapulted her to the CEO suite, stepping into new, unfamiliar roles that broaden their experience or require leadership amid crises are two of the hallmarks of successful CEOs we saw in our research. When Susan coaches her own employees, the number one skill she focuses on is openness to experience, taking on new challenges and soliciting feedback to improve along the way. 3. They acquire the skills they don't have. Rob Wenger, CEO and co-founder of the software-as-a-service company HireLogic, told us his favorite thing to do is write software. But after 2 years as CEO, he realized he had to engage more actively with his customers. Growing up, I couldn't stand in front of a group and talk. I purposefully changed just by doing what I dreaded over and over. I even surprised myself how much the practice itself changed me. 10 years ago, I dread dinner parties, and now I walk in and talk to everyone. So now I pick traits I want, and I take action. Rob also forced himself to practice by surrounding himself with people who enjoyed the activities he dreaded. My best friend Rico was very extroverted. He'd make me go to social things, and I'd give myself a job like setting up the music. Rob continued to flex and strengthen that social muscle until it became strong and natural. Under his leadership, his company has grown at a 44% average annual rate over 5 years and received a substantial private equity investment. Adaptable leaders work to acquire the skills they don't have. They get in the ring and practice them no matter how awkward or uncomfortable they feel at first. 4. They are willing to let go of the approaches that have worked before. Most of us imagine that when faced with uncertainty, the biggest challenge is setting the right strategy. In fact, most failures to adapt are the result of a leader's failure to let go of what has made him successful in the past. An engineer at Kodak invented the world's first digital camera, but company executives threw it into the proverbial broom closet for 18 years. Blockbuster had 3 chances to buy Netflix. In 1983, Intel faced a truly dramatic evolve-or-die challenge. The company had single-handedly created the market for memory chips. It was all they did. And yet, between 1984 and 1985, their profits dove from $198 million to $2 million. Japanese companies had turned chips into commodities and were now beating Intel blind. Their entire identity was memory. This wasn't just a financial crisis, but also an existential one. Andy Grove, Intel's founder and president at the time, tells the story in Only the Paranoid Survive, How to Exploit the Crisis Points That Challenge Every Company. After weeks of paralyzing angst, he found himself standing at a window, gazing out at a Ferris wheel in the distance. In that moment, he rose above the details, above the panic of crisis, even above his own ego. From that height, he was able to ask his CEO, Gordon Moore, the clear-headed question that would change Intel forever. If we got kicked out, and the board brought in a new CEO, what would that man do? Grove asked. Moore didn't miss a beat. A new CEO would get Intel out of the memory chip business. Grove stared at him numb. Why shouldn't you and I walk out the door, come back, and do it ourselves? He replied. That's exactly what they did. They shut down Intel's memory chip business and pioneered a new market, manufacturing microprocessors, that would increase Intel's market cap from $4 billion to $197 billion. The most successful CEOs we know, like Grove, become experts at letting go, whether that means letting go of past company strategies, business models, or their own personal habits. Craig Barnes, president of the Princeton Theological Seminary, PTS, since 2012, spent many years as a pastor before heading to Princeton. As a pastor, his calling was to be available and present to his people at their time of need. When he joined the seminary as president, he started out with the same one-on-one leadership approach he had enjoyed so much with his parishioners. His passion to be present and available drove him to keep his office door always open, and people flooded through it. But he soon came to realize that he would never accomplish his mandate, rebuilding the seminary to serve an increasingly global, diverse, and digital world, by spending all his time in one-on-one meetings. Those intimate, personal interactions had been in his comfort zone. They fueled his passion and his calling as a pastor. But once he was president, they left little time for Craig to think and set the vision that the institution sorely needed. He finally sat down with his assistant and blocked time on his calendar for the strategic and administrative work that needed to be done, and he stuck to it. Many of us who start our careers as craftsmen of sorts and who are passionate about our craft must let go of the very practices that drove our success in order to take on leadership roles. If this sounds trivial, it isn't. Changing any habit is difficult, but changing habits we love, that give us energy and fuel our passions, is almost impossible. We've seen many leaders who are eager to transform their organizations, yet vehemently resist letting go of meetings they like to attend or making other seemingly minor shifts in how they spend their time and energy. Craig's willingness to let go and change his habits paid off both for him and for PTS. Under his leadership, the seminary has thrived. The student body has grown by 30%, morale has improved dramatically, and several new academic programs have been launched. Great leaders, whatever their titles, are constantly becoming better, different, more informed. In this act of constant learning, they are becoming more comfortable with discomfort. Red flag, the control freak. Sam, a president who's on the CEO succession list for a retail manufacturer, received a 360 review. Kim asked him, "Have you shared the results with your direct reports?" The exec responded, "Well, no, that would show that I'm weak or not in control." We would argue that if you're not willing to get vulnerable and honest around your own needs for continued learning or what you need to let go, you're not ready to be CEO. Being open about your learning goals shows that you are willing to learn and grow and encourages your team to do so as well. Build an antenna for the future. Many employees and managers spend the bulk of their time focusing on near-term delivery and do just fine. But when one becomes a CEO, that goal no longer suffices. To keep the organization on a solid course, CEOs need to orient their focus to the future. The time leaders spend thinking beyond the next year into the future doubles when they become CEOs. Sucheta Nadkarni at Cambridge University has led research which studied the effect of temporal focus on adaptability. Looking at 221 firms in 19 industries over a 7-year period, the research showed that in dynamic industries, those firms with CEOs who focus mostly on the future, not the past or the present, were the ones that introduced new products faster, a litmus test for their ability to help their companies adapt. A meaningful glimpse of the future requires more than a 3-year strategy document. Brad Smith, the CEO of Intuit, describes an exercise that helped him stretch his time horizon further. Brad and fellow leaders were asked to reflect on a decision or a strategy they wished their predecessors had executed differently 10 years earlier to put the company in a better position today. Everyone had a field day with this portion of the exercise, quickly identifying the would-have, could-have, and should-haves. Oh, the benefit of hindsight is a magnificent thing, recalls Brad. But it was the second part of the exercise that brought the lesson home. They were asked to fast forward 10 years and think about what their successors might wish they had done differently. That shifted my perspective and made me realize that as CEO, things were now different. Beyond the short-term goals of delivering business results and even the 3 to 5 year plans, came the responsibility to consider the longer-term implications of everything I was doing today, says Brad. Most CEOs know they have to divide their attention between short- and long-term perspectives. The CEOs we interviewed spend significantly more of their time, over 40%, the equivalent of 2 days a week, thinking about the long-term. Other executives, by contrast, devoted an average of a day a week, or roughly 20% of their time, to long-term thinking. CEOs with the most effective future orientation have built an antenna for change. This antenna is the time and resources they commit to trawling the future. Certainly there are CEOs who seem naturally gifted at keeping their eyes on the future. But for the rest of us, we offer what has worked for the most adaptable CEOs we have encountered. 1. Build diverse information networks. To see into the future, your own market data isn't enough. Those who are best at spotting potential train wrecks and seizing opportunities look outside their own business, and often outside their industry, for signs of shifts. Actively curious, they assume that everything is relevant to their business in some way. The best CEOs plug into broad and seemingly unrelated information flows. Then they take all the information they gather and make creative connections to get out in front of the competition. Nadkarni found that CEOs who rated highly on openness to experience were more effective at initiating strategic change. They tap into broader networks and information sources, and as a result, are able to sense changes earlier and make strategic moves to take advantage of the changes. Jean Hoffman, who sold the pet pharmaceutical company she founded for $200 million, told us she was able to see where vet pharma was going to be in 30 years by looking at trends in human pharma. She didn't rely on what existing vet players were saying or writing. Looking at the data trends herself, as well as being able to see what pet owners wanted, and then thinking through how the vet sector would change, allowed her to get ahead of her market. As Tom Bell, former chairman and CEO of Young & Rubicam and Cousins Properties, told us, "In today's world, by the time you hear the words, 'we all know,' the next thing they say is likely wrong or at least disputable. The world has moved beyond it." One way these CEOs have proactively adapted is by expanding the definition of who their competitors are. They think beyond their own market boundaries. Disney World isn't competing against other theme parks. It competes against anything that vies for the attention and entertainment of parents and kids. The Naval Special Warfare Center, the Navy SEAL Training Center, arguably where they train the most adaptable warriors, lists outreach as one of its operating principles. For anything they do, they seek out the best experts across far-reaching disciplines. One of their officers told us, "Sometimes just having a conversation with people who do similar things but in very different contexts can open your mind. When they ask questions of you, they open up your blind spots and you're like, 'Wow, I didn't even think about that.'" To build a diverse network, Encourage regular interactions with bright, engaged people outside your company and outside your field. Assemble an inspiration cabinet who inspire you to consider new, unexpected ideas and help you see things from new angles. Share challenges. Bounce ideas off them. You might be surprised by what you learn. It's not hard to do. Highly adaptable leaders do it daily because they see it as vital. Others bury it on the bottom of the to-do list. 2. Use the power of questions. The best CEOs don't think of themselves as the ones with all the answers. Instead, they tend to ask the best questions. When Tom Bell was CEO and chairman of the real estate investment trust Cousins Properties, he asked what turned out to be a well over $1 billion question. Cousins owned a large amount of premium office space, including Atlanta's Bank of America building. But in early 2004, as real estate values were continuing to rise, one of Tom's direct reports told him that a key tenant intended to negotiate a lower lease rate. They looked into it and discovered that in many of Cousins' markets, lease rates in real dollars were trending down. Tom's question, "What do leasing prices look like for premium office space in other markets?" led them to dig into the data. What they found was that the downswing wasn't just taking place in Cousins' markets, it was nearly nationwide. Tom considered what this news meant and came back with an unorthodox idea. Let's sell the assets. His team was aghast, but Tom convinced them to move forward, and they sold a little over $1 billion in office assets at the height of the market. Cousins shareholders were rewarded with incredible dividends, something that had never been done at that point in the public REIT world. Tom says, "I remember getting calls from other REIT CEOs asking what the hell was I thinking. I certainly wondered if I made the wrong call." Then the U.S. real estate bubble burst, vacancies soared, and property values and rents plummeted following the economic collapse in the United States. The Bank of America building that Tom sold for $436 million in 2006 was foreclosed upon in the wake of the real estate meltdown in 2012. It traded in 2016 for roughly $180 million. In hindsight, Tom's call seems blindingly obvious, but it was not so at the time. How did he decide to make that controversial call? He started by asking questions. He paused when he heard something that caused him to second-guess his assumptions. Then he built a fact base, and he acted. Asking good questions was an approach Tom Bell learned at a young age. Early in his career, he had been promoted far beyond his experience level. A mentor pulled him into his office and warned him he'd be in many conversations he wouldn't understand. "You must get underneath what they are telling you. Here's what you do," he said. "First, pay attention. Let them get about halfway into something they really think is important and then interrupt. Ask, 'Wait, tell me why you think that is important.' That forces them to back up and describe the assumptions, the facts, and the logic. Second, beware the declarative statement. When someone makes a point as if it is a fact by saying, 'Everyone knows that,' or 'We all agree that,' stop them and say, 'Wait, do you have data to back that up?'" Being curious is a hallmark of adaptable CEOs, and it can start with a question as simple as "what," "how," or "tell me more." Hal Gregerson at MIT is a world-renowned expert on innovation who invites every leader to set aside 4 minutes every 24 hours, totaling one full day each year, to ask better questions. Earlier in discussing Jim Smith of Thomson Reuters, we claimed that journalism was a promising path to the C-suite. Why did we suggest that? Well, who is more expert at asking probing, insightful questions than a journalist? Jim told us that his curiosity Both his natural curiosity about the way the world worked, as well as the sense of curiosity he developed professionally, was one of the most important contributors to his success as a CEO. When the going gets tough, the tough open their reporter's notebook. They ask questions and they learn. 3. Tackle pre-mortems before post-mortems. With infinite available data and so many directions to look in, how does someone who aspires to reach the corner office separate signal from noise? Gene Wade is the co-founder and CEO of One Uni Incorporated, which builds apps that allow students around the world to get a college education via their mobile phone. He is no stranger to the pains of adapting in a quickly changing environment. At my prior company, Platform Learning, we built this really great business that grew like a rocket ship, but it was built on quicksand, he told us. The regulatory environment shifted so fast that they often didn't see new changes coming. Looking back, Gene realized that he wasn't blindsided because there were no signals. The problem was that his antenna was down. I was so busy scaling up the business that I didn't really keep my eye on the regulations. Today, he actively leads teams in a practice that he calls the pre-mortem to keep his antenna tuned to finding the signals amid the noise. He explores with his team. Let's say it's 18 months out and we've failed. What are all the plausible reasons? Now imagine we were wildly successful. Tell me what happened. Once they've created failure scenarios, and to Gene, there are no givens in business, only potential scenarios, they develop a signal list for each issue. What data, news, or trends need to be tracked to stay on top of the issue? What steps can be taken today to increase the odds that the success scenario becomes reality? Beware cognitive overload. The economist Herbert Simon suggested that the human brain has hard cognitive limits. He came up with the incredibly prescient dictum, "A wealth of information creates a poverty of attention." We have found that when it comes to effectively adapting to change, one differentiator between mediocre managers and those who rise to the top is the ability to insulate themselves from cognitive overload. CEO Don Zier is a star in striking this balance. Don has been the CEO of Nutrisystem since late 2012, when she embarked on an ambitious 4-point turnaround and growth plan. The overall result is a resurgence at Nutrisystem under Don's leadership. An MIT engineer by training, Don is a naturally analytical thinker. When she arrived at Nutrisystem, an e-commerce company by trade, she was surprised by how many decisions were not fact-based, especially given how much data was available. In those early days, the team would show up and literally do a data dump. They delivered spreadsheets and spreadsheets of so much data, but hadn't identified the data points that mattered. They couldn't tell the story of what was happening or what the key insights were for the decision at hand. As the team matured, we began developing data dashboards that focused on what mattered. And that's when it got exciting, and the data went from potentially overwhelming to quite powerful. Data placed in a clear context and shaped by critical questions began to deliver real knowledge and a roadmap for the future for Nutrisystem. 4. Look into the crystal ball of customer experience. The successful CEOs we studied spend roughly 20% of their time with customers, even with the burden of so many new demands on their time. We did not see them decrease the amount of time they spent with customers when they moved into the CEO role. They realized that there's no replacement for personal contact with the market. Customers don't always know exactly what they need or how to articulate it. For this reason, the CEOs, who get the best insights from the market, pay the most attention to what customers are experiencing. Then they search for solutions from there. In 2005, a CEO we worked with, Marcus, took the helm of a family-owned business that is a leading supplier to the construction industry in Europe. Marcus discovered some of his best ideas by walking the construction sites of his customers. On one such tour, a problem and possibility hit him simultaneously. There were so many nails lying everywhere. They were running out of high-volume supplies way faster than planners had anticipated. For low-cost items like nails, it was hard for them to accurately forecast when they would need the product and how much. Suppliers of these products were fiercely competing on price. Right then, I saw the customer's chief problem wasn't pricing. Their chief problem was getting the right quantity of the right supplies exactly when they needed it to ensure their staff was productive. The cost of idle workers at construction sites, Marcus realized, was far more expensive to builders than the price of a box of nails. Marcus's solution was to adapt their business model to set up shop right at the construction site of his customers, who could then get whatever they needed whenever they needed it. In doing so, he provided immediate access and drove better margins for himself at a time when his competitors were focused on pricing. By walking the customer site and seeing what was and wasn't working firsthand, Marcus uncovered a significant opportunity to improve profits. Assess your adapt behavior. Ask yourself, am I uncomfortable now? What is driving that? What am I working on improving personally? When is the last time I shed something, product, process, practice, that had made me or my business successful in the past? Am I doing this simply because I'm comfortable doing it this way, or because this is what is needed in this situation? Am I approaching divergent points of view with an open mind? Key takeaways. 1. Train your adaptation muscles. Pick up a new skill or hobby. Immerse yourself in an experience or place that you find uncomfortable. Take on a job or volunteer assignment in a completely new area. 2. Let go of the past. Conduct annual spring cleaning. Ask yourself and your team which habits, practices, and assumptions hold you back today or in the future. Pick the one that feels easiest or most valuable to let go. Let it go. 3. Build your antenna for the future. Assemble an inspiration cabinet, a network of people in different fields who expose you to new unexpected ideas and information and help you see things from new angles. Schedule foresight time at least twice a month. Actually block time on your calendar to consider the big picture view and future scenarios. Pick a location, time, and conditions that put your mind in the best state for insight. Conduct full immersion into customer experience. Regularly spend time walking in the shoes of your customers. Get curious and ask questions. Adding it all up. Each of the 4 CEO genome behaviors discussed in Section 1 of this book is treated as distinct, self-contained, and equally important. In reality, they are interconnected. For example, it might be easy to build a business management system in the spirit of delivering relentless reliability and then become a slave to process. However, with an equally strong adapt muscle, you will be actively seeking to leave behind processes that no longer work in the face of changing customer needs or competitive context. Jeff Bezos, in his 2016 shareholder letter, said it best. If you're not watchful, the process can become the thing. You stop looking at outcomes and just make sure you're doing the process right. A more experienced leader will use a bad outcome as an opportunity to investigate and improve the process. In the desire to decide with conviction and speed, it might seem easy to railroad your decision through the organization, resulting in a lack of alignment and failed execution. Yet, with strong engage for impact muscles, you will understand the needs of the key stakeholders and thoughtfully align their actions with your intent. The second reality is that context matters. The relative importance of each of the four CEO genome behaviors varies widely, depending on the industry, company, and point in time. It is hard to imagine a technology startup, for example, that thrives with a CEO who lacks the ability to adapt. On the other hand, you wouldn't want to be a patient in the hospital where the CEO isn't personally committed to reliability in everything the hospital does. To be highly successful, your strongest behaviors should match the behaviors most needed to drive value in the business. And even if you have weaknesses, you can learn to thrive by building your strengths over time, as well as by proactively harnessing the strengths of others. Surround yourself with people who bring complementary skills and experience to the table. For example, Matt Kramer, the former co-CEO of Teach for America, shared with us that while he is strong on delivering reliably and being decisive, he depends on other people to support his ability to reflect on the future, a key element of the adapt behavior. I have to be in regular conversation with people who have well-developed antennae. I cannot be surrounded by people who are heads down. The bottom line is that you do not have to be a superman or superwoman to be a successful CEO or to grow to your potential. There is no perfect all-weather leader at any level who excels at all four of the behaviors we discussed. However, the CEO position does require a baseline level of proficiency in all four behaviors and a pronounced strength in one or more. The strongest CEOs in our data set are 10 times more likely to be skilled in more than one of these behaviors than the weaker CEOs we analyzed. Many of the strong CEOs got there by identifying where they were weak and working to build strength over time. Most important, it's never too early or too late to strengthen your muscles on any of the four behaviors. To help you measure where you are today on your path to the top and to suggest ideas on how to improve, we have created a diagnostic online at www.ceogenome.com. Section 2. Get to the top. Win your dream job. Career catapults. Stand out. Close the deal. Chapter 6. Career Catapults. Fast Track Your Future. Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards. Søren Kierkegaard. At the age of 14, Scott Clawson set a goal of becoming a CEO one day. Surrounded with plenty of CEOs in the family, his father, grandfather, and later on his brother were all CEOs. For Scott, taking the helm of a company was a natural career destination. Since childhood, Scott had stood out for his hard work and competitiveness. He charted a bulletproof path to the top, following in his family's footsteps. With a 3.96 GPA from Brigham Young University, Scott spent 2 years at his father's business gaining the work experience required to qualify for admission to Harvard's MBA program. Graduating from Harvard in the top 15% of his class gave him a strong platform for a steady rise through the ranks as he took on roles of increasing scope and authority, first at Alcoa and later at Danaher. At the age of 42, Scott stepped into his first CEO role at GSI, a role that seemed almost predestined. Scott went on to deliver a home run for GSI investors, selling the company only 4 years later at 3.8 times the original investment. His second CEO role at the helm of the water treatment company Culligan ended in a successful sale to a private equity firm. If you're scratching your head saying, "That's not me," you're not alone. While Scott's trajectory looks picture-perfect, it is not nearly as common as you might have thought before reading this book. The reality is that over 70% of the CEOs we have interviewed had no idea they wanted to be a CEO until they reached senior executive roles late in their career. In other words, they didn't plan their career as a set of steps to become CEO. Most didn't work at academy companies like GE or P&G. Most didn't get an MBA at an elite business school. Yet as these future CEOs advanced in their careers, their aspirations grew. In 2014, Korn Ferry did a study of just over 1,000 senior executives, and an astounding 87% wanted to achieve the top job. Even armed with the CEO genome behaviors you have learned in Section 1 of this book, you might still find career choices daunting. How do you know which paths lead to the top and which end in blind alleys? We have analyzed almost 1,000 career journeys to the CEO suite to give you the inside track to the top. Here's the punchline. Your career trajectory is the output of two factors that have a multiplying effect: getting results in the right roles and getting noticed for those results. This chapter will show how their career choices positioned future CEOs to hone their skills and demonstrate CEO-worthy results. In Chapter 7, we will demystify the art of getting noticed to help you achieve full recognition and professional growth for your results. Launching your career to the top. Most CEOs don't start out their careers with the goal of becoming a CEO. Nevertheless, we saw patterns emerge in the routes to the top. Take Christine, a first-time CEO we recommended several years ago to run a health and wellness company. She went on to move the company from a crisis to profitability in fewer than 12 months. Christine was the daughter of horse trainers and was brought up working 7 days a week next to her boss, her dad. She worked full-time while in college and lived at home. Her resume looks nothing like the typical Fortune 500 career path, adroitly described in a Forbes magazine article. After graduation, grab a few years of related work experience before heading back to school for an MBA at a top university, and then follow that up with a stint at Bain or McKinsey. Finally, make the jump to the company you hope to lead one day, and be sure to get some operational experience and international exposure. Christine never received an MBA, never joined a management consulting firm, and was an external recruit when she became CEO. Yet her career story is right in line with an experiential trajectory that we identified across almost 1,000 journeys to the CEO suite. On average, CEOs we have analyzed took 24 years to get from day one in their first job to the CEO role. There is no one-size-fits-all prescription. Each journey is unique. However, we have uncovered several common patterns on the way to the top that can help guide your choices. CEOs' careers are roughly divided into three stages. Each stage has a role to play in preparing one for the top. Many of the insights that follow are helpful to anyone looking for professional growth at any stage in one's career, whether or not the C-suite is the ultimate goal. Stage 1. Go broad. Year 0 to 8. The position of CEO requires one to be the ultimate generalist. We see roots of that profile early in future CEOs' career trajectories. They build a wide breadth of skills and experiences early on by moving across functions, industries, companies, and geographies. Making unconventional moves is both easiest and least risky at this stage. For those starting out their careers in large companies, this diversity of early experiences often comes from rotational programs that offer new recruits opportunities to try their hand at different parts of the business. In professional services companies, working on projects solving different types of problems for clients across a wide range of industries delivers similar exposure. Smaller startup companies also afford an opportunity to wear multiple hats at the same time. Some future CEOs accelerate their progress at this stage with an MBA, either a full-time program or part-time around a demanding work schedule. As for Christine, she started as a horse trainer, later taught financial literacy classes, and then shifted into corporate training before opening new retail stores for a fitness company. No matter your starting point, the key priority guiding choices in this first stage is to maximize the breadth and pace of your learning, ideally in direct contact with role models for high professional standards. Much like early life experiences, early professional experiences form a powerful imprint that influences one's views on what is possible. This makes it even more important to learn from a broad range of people, styles, and situations. This is also a time to build valuable foundational skills that will be harder to master later, particularly problem-solving, financial analysis, and oral and written communication skills. Stage 2. Go deep. Years 9 to 16. If Stage 1 is about learning above all, Stage 2 is about measurable results above all. Years 9 to 16 are typically spent building leadership ability, depth of industry experience, and a track record of results. The CEOs in our sample had on average 13 to 16 years of experience in the same industry as the company they were seeking to lead. In these years, future CEOs work toward general management roles that directly drive top-line and/or bottom-line revenue or profits. That might mean running a P&L, or it might mean being a functional leader in sales, marketing, or operations. Most important, future CEOs are demonstrating that they can lead others to produce outsized, measurable results. Over 90% of our CEOs had general management experience prior to becoming CEO. On average, CEOs have 11 years of general management experience under their belt before stepping into their first CEO role. Christine eventually held a North American general management role, responsible for a $400 million portfolio of retail stores for a company within the fitness industry. According to Kaplan and Sorensen's research on our data, divisional P&L roles are the most common stepping stone to CEO. In this second stage, career stories of leaders who go on to become strong CEOs are peppered with examples such as, "I took the Southwest region from the worst performing to top quartile across the company," or, "I turned marketing from a dusty department producing PowerPoint charts into a generator of 90% of new million-dollar leads in the company," or, "I built the plant in Mexico in record time and on budget, unprecedented for our company." Stage 2 is the time to show measurable impact and value as a result of your leadership. Stage 3. Go high. Year 17 to 24. Stage 3 is where we see careers of future CEOs take a dramatically different turn. While many will remain effective functional leaders, middle managers, or even P&L operators, future CEOs differentiate themselves as enterprise leaders. As enterprise leaders, they make decisions taking into account the context and impact of the entire business, rather than confining their view only to their own area, and they impact results beyond their immediate scope of authority. At this stage, future CEOs impact success of the entire company. By the time they finish this third stage, roughly 24 years into their career, future CEOs have typically held 8 to 11 positions, which translates to between 2 to 3 years of tenure per role. They also have been exposed to between 4 and 6 companies. When appointing CEOs, boards look for them to have roughly a 10-year runway in the role. Approximately 3/4 of finalist candidates for CEO positions fall between the ages of 40 and 54, and only 5% are over 58 years old. Many cross the finish line into the CEO role through placement by executive recruiters. In our analysis of 91 mid-market first-time CEO hirings, 30% were sourced through recruiters, as was Christine. More important, leaders start to look like future CEOs in this final period when they succeed in growing influence and demonstrating initiative beyond the formal authority of any given role. For example, a vice president might lead a company-wide initiative that requires him to influence peers and other senior players who don't report to him. Christine, for example, initiated discussion about, advocated the business case for, and ultimately led the implementation of a company-wide ERP, the company's largest investment for that year, which impacted every function and commercial team. This is also the time in which future CEOs expand their reach beyond the walls of their company. They build a brand within their industry, taking visible conversation-defining positions on the driving questions of the day and communicating them through speaking opportunities, the media, and by convening other CEOs and leaders. There are no ready-made maps to the top, especially for those in the first two stages of their career. No matter where you are today, the real takeaway is this. Don't look at your career as a succession of jobs to land. Instead, look at your decisions as a portfolio of experiences to build. Is your career portfolio CEO ready? What follows are the common requirements we have seen in hundreds of CEO selection processes we've supported. It is rare that a single candidate meets all the requirements, but building a portfolio of experiences that covers at least five of these areas makes it easier to get on the slate of final candidates. Industry experience. P&L leadership on a similar scale. Evidence of strong people leadership. Signs that you can attract and develop talent. People look at your Glassdoor ratings. Proven success in a relevant context. For example, M&A if the company needs to grow through acquisition, growth if that's the primary goal, etc. Breadth of experience across different types of business problems and roles. For example, delivering growth and improving operational efficiencies. Strategic vision and ability to set direction and champion change. Operational and financial acumen. Ability to work with the board and external stakeholders. International experience where relevant. To help you make the smartest choices in building your portfolio of experiences, we closely investigated a sample of 60 leaders who made it to the CEO seat faster than the average 24 years. We called these CEOs sprinters. Our research team analyzed sprinters' career histories in great depth to understand patterns of choices and experiences shared among them. Not surprisingly, we found that nearly a quarter of sprinters benefited from an elite MBA program. But a much bigger discovery was that 97% of sprinters, virtually all of them, undertook what we came to call career catapults. Career catapults are inflection points that accelerated strong performers to top-level leadership, both in terms of their capabilities and in terms of how others saw their potential. Whether or not you have an MBA from an elite business school or work with a marquee company, you can actively seek out and create career catapults to accelerate your trajectory at any stage in your career. By spotting catapult opportunities, seizing them, and ultimately building your leadership capabilities, you will increase your odds of becoming a CEO candidate more quickly and will accelerate your career no matter where you are headed. Career catapult number one, the big leap. When it comes to proving CEO mettle, there is no more powerful catapult than what we call the big leap. What do we mean by that? Accepting the challenge of a role that is a big stretch from what you have done previously, either because the role is much larger than anything you've done before, or because it takes you into unfamiliar territory. With a big leap, you may find yourself overnight managing 100 times more people than you ever have before, or taking on roles for which you don't have the required experience. A big leap, when successful, demonstrates you have the ability to thrive in a new, uncertain environment. It demonstrates your ability to scale